She's always been the type of person that just says things and she just speaks her mind. I guess that has a little bit to do with not having a formal education.
Welcome to episode 7 of The Body Serve. This is a very special episode. This is one that we've been planning for a long time. We've been tasked by one of our followers, Mel, Athena1949, to talk about what makes a good tennis commentator. And from that, we've been playing with a few ideas. And so this episode has kind of grown from that. And we're going to be starting out with unpacking some of the ideas of what we think make a good tennis commentator and then kind of throwing a few people under the bus.
Yeah, we're going to go off.
With the main target being Justin Gimelstob. So if you're one of those people, who I'm sure there are many, who have been harboring ill will toward him for years, because he has quite the track record, then this will be the episode for you.
Put on a pot of tea and settle in.
So if we were to simply answer Mel's question, what makes a good commentator, what would you start with?
I would say, paradoxically, don't talk so much. You know, you're being paid to talk, obviously, but...
We're not being paid to talk.
Yeah, we're giving this to you for free. Yes.
But we are also very mindful about the things we say and what people would want to listen to and not want to listen to. This is not something. Yeah, this is not something that tennis commentators are often aware of, it seems.
And we should say the sort of the BBC model mm-hmm. of commentary is a lot of silence, you know?
I'm a colonial subject. So I'm very partial to the understated things of the world.
Of course. Yeah, so American tennis commentators, I think we all know, talk entirely too much. A lot of them talk during the points. They chat about stuff that's not even relevant to what's going on. They talk about the celebrities in the crowd.
You know, these North American tennis broadcasts where you have somebody in the stands, courtside, who's whispering. You know, I think James is like really emotionally unstable right now. Like, you know, why right. do we need, what does that add to a broadcast?
Because
you know?
They're like 15 feet closer than the booth.
Right.
So like it's, you know, it's 1 degree warmer out here. So that could be having a huge effect. The wind is swirling. They always talk about the wind mm-hmm. swirling. which, you know, there is a lot of value in telling fans what it's actually like on the court, because
yes.
TV is so sanitized, right? You can't tell what the elements are mm-hmm. like, how fast the ball is going.
It's
those
not,
are things I want to hear.
It's not like Judy Rankin on the golf course at a major tournament.
I don't know, who's that?
Well, she's a little old lady
okay.
who had a very big and successful pro golfing career, who then parlayed that into a golfing commentary career. And so she would be the on-the-course reporter, correspondent, telling you, you know, she'd be the person you'd hear setting up the golf shots
oh,
on
okay.
the course. I love Judy. what she does has merit. You know, that's my point.
Okay.
She adds a lot to the broadcast. I feel like a lot of this with tennis is just superfluous, you know?
Yeah. And we hear, you know, we hear the same stories a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, did you know that Anna Ivanovic learned how to play tennis in a swimming pool, an empty swimming pool, and they were dodging bombs in Serbia? Like, I actually just learned that.
Yeah, it's the narratives, the regurgitating of narratives is one of the biggest problems in tennis commentary.
Right. So don't talk so much.
No.
That's our advice.
I mean, you watch a BBC feed of, say, Wimbledon, and you can watch an entire game and there's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You hear nothing and you're just watching and it's glorious.
Mm-hmm. Except, what a brilliant passage of play.
No, but wrapped up in that is an assumption and this is key, an assumption that the audience knows what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And the flip side of that is a lot of this tennis commentary talks down to the audience. You know, dumbing it down way too much.
It's, you know, in the U.S., where, as I said, tennis is not as big a sport, you have to kind of toe the line between educating your audience and expecting them to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, I know a lot of people who like to watch the big matches in tennis, but still have trouble with the rules and the scoring. So some of the background and color really helps them keep up.
Yes.
But
there's a time and a place. It's right. Not when it's breakpoint down and you are 10 shots into the rally, mm-hmm. You know.
And the things that don't help those people keep up, like relationships that have ended 10, 15 years ago, these old boring stories about them coming up, you know, these things need to take a hike. So my other, something that I think makes a good commentator is, you know, show us why you're an expert. You know, you were hired for a reason, mm-hmm. because you bring something unique. You bring a studied and educated perspective to commentary, right? Ideally.
One of the ways that tennis commentary fails is that a lot of these commentators are former players or people who have come up in the game. And so the standard that we'd expect for somebody calling an NCAA championship game, somebody who's gone to college for this kind of thing, mm-hmm. it's not what we're getting in tennis. Right?
Right.
And so the qualifications to be a tennis commentator are less.
But, you know, I feel like all sports have former players.
They do.
You know.
There's usually one, like the color guy, you know, or the color woman, you know, giving color commentary or whatever. But almost all in tennis are former players.
That's true. You know, sometimes you have a Chris Fowler to balance it out, mm-hmm. or Hannah Storm, Chris McKendry. I will say, on that note, Brad Gilbert is actually one of my favorite commentators. Yes. And, you know, he will tell you his level of discourse is not university level, right? And that's great. For him, that works so well because he adds such personality and such insight.
I'm not trying to be a snob about mm-hmm. it. I'm just trying to explain why it would fail in some instances, you know?
No, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Brad works very well. And when you pair him with somebody like Darren Cahill, you know, they're, wait for it, they're killer. Duo.
That is a pun worthy of Brad Gilbert. But, you know, if I don't know if I could listen to two Brad Gilberts talk to each other, but what he brings is something really special with his nicknames.
Yeah, and he's carved out his niche with his nicknames. It's actually funny.
He also comes across as a very good-natured guy,
mm-hmm.
and he's not really putting down the players like a lot of commentators do. You know, if you're a commentator, you have to show us why you've been hired. Why you're the expert. You know, dazzle us. Cliff Drysdale.
Is that so much to ask? Dazzle me, people.
Seriously. We're here to be entertained. No, but Cliffy loves to do those little, those slow motion breakdowns of players' strokes. Which, you know, they're a little corny, but I've actually learned some things. If he knows what he's talking about, let the man show you what he knows.
When we're laying the groundwork for this episode, watching the 2 weeks of the Australian Open was very instructive, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how many times did we watch that tournament and listen to matches being called where multiple commentators on the same match had different pronunciations for the same player within the course of the same match?
Right.
And this is something we talked about previously in another episode.
Mm-hmm.
But this should be the bare minimum that you should bring to the table as a commentator. Learn people's names and how to pronounce them, you know? For one, I'm sure you have people in studio who can do research to find out. And additionally, most of these people, because of their, you know, conflicts of interest, which we'll get into later, mm-hmm. and their history in the game, they have access to players where they can, I can say, Jim, how do you pronounce Jim?
Right.
You know? And then you make a note, and then you use it for your job for which you're paid. You know?
And consider how many foreign journalists are there covering the tournament. You know, they're, just ask someone.
It's mind-blowing.
It really reflects this stereotypically American sort of willful ignorance. Mm-hmm. You know, just a kind of, it's not malice, but it's this sort of idea that, you know, I don't really need to learn how to pronounce someone's name.
Yeah.
Because who cares, right? So another thing that really riles me about commentary is when commentators criticize players' bodies. And this happens with men and women. So, you know, there's a lot of, like, joking about, you know, certain men who have a gut or are a little chubby or, you know, don't seem like they're in great shape. Just, like, stop. Who cares? We can all see what they look like. And, you know, there was so much chatter about Marion Bartoli, obviously, the way she looked and her unorthodox training patterns. But and there was just a lot of veiled criticism of her shape, you know. And so I think that respect is a bare minimum.
Yes. So what are some of the conflicts of interests that we know of with these tennis commentators?
Where
do you start?
This is a really...
I'm looking at your list now, and it's really long.
I made this list off the top of my head, too. So this is a common refrain among people who follow tennis, is that the conflicts of interest are rife, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Mary Jo Fernandez is married to Tony Godsick, who was Federer's agent for many, many years. Chris Evert has a tennis academy.
And so every time she's talking about an up-and-coming young American player, this is likely somebody that she's worked with intimately for a very long time.
But they're not always telling you, they're not disclosing that.
No.
You know? So the layperson may not know that this young American has been working in Florida.
At her academy.
For years, right? Patrick McEnroe was the head of player development at the USTA. Lindsay Davenport coaches Madison Keys. Justin Gimelstob coaches John Isner.
We'll see how long that lasts.
Martina Navratilova, who happens to be one of my favorite commentators, is now coaching Radwanska. So all of these people have conflicts of interest. They have a kind of a vested interest in the outcomes of certain matches.
Yeah, say for example, Navratilova is calling a match, and the winner will most likely then go on to play Radwanska.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not calling her ethics into question, but it's something that as a viewer, as an informed viewer, it makes me really aware of the things that she's saying.
Right.
Which I don't feel like I necessarily should be in that position. You know, I don't need to be sitting down wondering, trying to unpack everything that I'm listening to find hidden meaning, you know? That's not what I'm looking for in my tennis.
And it's strange that she would literally have a financial stake in the outcome of a match. You know, why is a commentator even put in that position? And it happens all the time. And it happened during the Australian Open with Tennis Channel. So I think maybe we should start, though, why are the conflicts of interest a bad thing? We kind of presuppose that they're a problem.
Yes.
But we rarely kind of unpack why they're a problem.
This is kind of like a writing a thesis 101, right? You can't just state the problem. You have to explain why it is a problem.
We've made an assumption. So why are conflicts of interest troubling to us? So for one, I think they make tennis look bad. And, you know, maybe they only make it look bad to the people who are really well-informed.
Yeah.
That could
Because the people who don't know about these inside connections, they would have no way of situating it, you know? So maybe we are making more of it in certain instances than it needs to be. But it's still something very worth talking about.
Yeah, and, you know, tennis is a small world, really, and a lot of the people who are involved in the administration of tennis and in coaching and all that stuff are kind of a tight-knit community and have been former players. And
if I'm understanding you correctly, then you're saying it is hard to eliminate all conflicts of interest.
Agreed.
Okay.
Nearly
I would
impossible.
Agree with that, yes.
Now, another issue that I have with conflicts of interest is that I think it cheapens the product. So let me say first that I don't expect any sort of commentary to be unbiased. That's unreasonable, and it's also not the point of commentary, right?
We don't even really expect that from tennis writing.
No.
You know, there's we've talked about this before, where a lot of people go in hard on some of the tennis writers for, you know, perceived biases and whatnot, but, you know, it's almost impossible.
Mm-hmm. And with this kind of outrage culture that we live in, those are things you're going to have to deal with as a writer or mm-hmm. or a commentator, no matter how prudent you are, you know. So that being said, although we don't expect objectivity, I do think that these conflicts sort of, they give off an inferior product.
But also, we almost never see these conflicts acknowledged. And that's
exactly.
One of the biggest problems. Mm. I'm totally open to people having their biases as writers and commentators and whatnot, so long as they're acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
That goes a long way toward creating an openness surrounding, you know, the tennis narratives and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But when people are intentionally hiding them, then it becomes a little bit more mm-hmm. seedy, you know?
Which I find has happened a lot with Patrick McEnroe's commentary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's also an expectation from commentators like him that we're really invested in American players.
Yes.
As much as he is.
Mm-hmm.
He's literally financially invested
yes.
in them. We are not. Nor are we that emotionally invested.
His job with the USTA at the time, he no longer is in that position, was dependent on him developing young U.S. talent. So mm-hmm. when he's on air championing the next great U.S. star, he is boosting himself in the
right.
same breath. It's so seedy.
Exactly. Yeah, and so, like, the PR aspect of his job is coming through on TV. And there's no place for that.
And it's additionally muddied by the fact that this is being, at times, it's a U.S. tournament being broadcast by the biggest sports station in the world, ESPN. Mm-hmm. And so they themselves have a vested interest in championing a young U.S. star to their audience so that they can boost their ratings. You know, everybody has a vested interest
right.
that's operating beneath the surface that we don't really always, that most people, I would say, aren't aware of.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you pointed that out, too, because these conflicts are actually to the detriment of a lot of players from other countries
yes.
Who are very successful, but we may not hear much about.
And then we wonder why certain players don't have much of a market in the U.S.
Right.
You know?
You know, maybe, let's say, maybe Safarov is your favorite player.
Yeah.
Or even Berdych or Gulbis, God forbid. Or, you know, these players who aren't American may not get the same kind of play. And the commentators often don't even know that much about them.
No.
You know? And that's not to say a lot of commentators really do their homework. But
that then is a failure on the part of the networks.
That's
for
true.
For the
yeah.
the crews that they assemble to call these matches, right?
Mm-hmm. And because, also the matches they choose to air.
Yes. Because if they were really concerned with providing a more well-rounded product, they would have people who were more knowledgeable in all facets of the game and familiar with people from all over the world, mm-hmm. not just in North America or more popular players.
Yeah, so I guess that gets at the heart of, you know, what is the purpose of commentary? What's the purpose of tennis broadcasting? Is it to create a well-balanced product that expands the horizons of its viewers? Clearly, at this point, it's not. Is it to sell commercial space? Yes, of mm-hmm. course. But that doesn't mean that quality cannot coexist with the commercial mechanism, you know?
And we've seen countless times somebody win one match as a 16-year-old at the US Open. And we hear about them ad nauseum for the rest of the 2 weeks. And then we never hear from them again. That's part of the tennis machine, the tennis media machine, in trying to create this new star product for the American public to consume, to keep this cycle going.
And it's interesting now that Twitter is such a factor in, well, everything. But as soon as you can see the network starting to tout this new star, people on Twitter are like, please don't ruin this. You know? It feels like this force pushing back against it.
There are also the very amateur mistakes that some of these commentators make on air. How many times what was it that Everett did at the Australian Open?
I can't remember if I talked about this on the podcast.
I'll let him have it again.
So Chris Evert brought up this weird stat over and over, and she just could not get it right. So she said that Sharapova has never beaten a Russian player, or has never lost to a Russian player in a slam. And then she's like, no, that's not true. And then she changed it to, she's never lost to a Russian player in the past 5 years. Which is also not true.
Mm-hmm.
But it just was put out there and it just floated out there.
Where is she getting this information from?
And then she says on air, somebody, I wrote this in my notes, where did I get it from? And it was, I'm looking at the TV and I'm like, am I the only one hearing this? This is so strange and so unprofessional. You're Chris Evert.
Like, you write this in an academic paper? Like, that's the end of you. You write that in your master's thesis? That's it.
Do you go to your defense and say, I don't remember why I wrote that down?
It just came to me at night.
I realize the standards aren't the same.
Totally different. But that also speaks to how drastically different the standards are in tennis.
Right.
And lower relative to other sports.
That's, you know, I would find it hard to believe that in a sport like football or basketball, where statistics are everywhere and they're easy to access, I don't think a mistake like that would happen. Or at least it would be corrected very quickly. Because my issue with this mistake was that it wasn't corrected.
It happened over and over again and that she, in different matches.
She flubbed the same one again, you know? So this also speaks to a lack of stat keeping in tennis and the difficulty of finding a centralized database for all these statistics.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, what I did was went on the WTA website and looked up Sharapova, and there's all her matches ever.
It's really all
so
right
if
there.
You want to see the last time she lost to a Russian player, it's there. It's so easy. Or Wikipedia or Google. Come on, Chris.
There was also this hilarious moment where this must have been Tennis Channel. They presented a statistic that Serena was the oldest semifinalist or finalist at a Grand Slam since I don't know who, like maybe Billie Jean King or something, right? And then Martina, it was presented as on screen. It was written on screen and somebody beside her read it. And then she said, no, that's not true. Hello.
That was me.
1994, Wimbledon. Yeah. And so, 20 minutes later, they come back and correct themselves, you know?
Yeah.
That was probably just more like a hilarious error more than indicative of something larger.
Right, you know? Right. And actually, Chris McKendry made this weird statement in the Australian Open, too, that really bugged me. And she said that Madison Keys was the first American teen semifinalist in a major since Serena.
Okay.
Which is not true. Because Sloane Stephens was a semifinalist 2 years ago.
Three now, right?
No, it was 2013. Oh. Yeah.
That seems like forever ago.
I mean, if a casual fan can rebut that in just a few seconds, like, come on, people.
Yeah. This goes back to your call for showing us your expertise, right? It almost feels as though they're trying to wow us, but failing miserably. You know, it's like just trying a little bit too hard.
And, you know, I know it's not an easy job. I'm sure it's really hard, and not many people can do it. But being on TV is a constant audition. So show us why you're there, you know?
And the sad part about it, I mean, you and I would love to be in their position.
Absolutely.
You know, if somebody's out there listening to us, we're available, you know? And so we're not trained to do this. Some of them weren't trained to do it. They're learning on the fly as well as we are.
Right.
People just don't go to university to study to become a tennis commentator. You know, like that's not a degree. You know, and so there is a learning as you go aspect to it. But you have to at least show that you're trying. You know, you can't be making these errors all the time repeatedly.
And maybe play to your strengths.
Yeah.
You know? If telling anecdotes and telling stories about your playing days is where you excel, try to keep it fun and keep it relevant.
Okay, so I'll ask you this then. Why we agree on this, and I'm sure most of the tennis world agrees with this, that Darren Cahill is miles better than almost anybody as far as tennis commentary goes, right? ESPN, so what makes him so much better than everybody else?
Well, Darren, he's clever and analytical in a very unshowy way, in a really modest way that I think makes him likable.
He doesn't take himself too seriously.
Right. He doesn't really talk about his career very much, which...
He talks about his coaching career.
That's true, yeah. Which, you know, he has a lot to be proud of in that area.
Andre Hewitt.
Right. But I don't know, there's something just unassuming about Darren Cahill that makes you believe him. And it's a stark contrast to some of the American commentators. And I can say that because I'm American. Mm-hmm.
I can't believe, though, that it's just an American tennis problem, though. Because I know I guess that's the problem with being saturated by American tennis coverage, is that I'm so familiar with the American tennis commentators that I don't really know the names of a lot of the international ones.
Yeah.
But it's not just an American problem, you know?
We just don't really have access, you know? I mean, if we wanted to stream tennis online, we could. But yeah, I'm just talking about what I know.
Okay.
Chris Evert's husband, John Lloyd, is a commentator on BBC, right?
Yeah.
And he's actually quite good. Mm-hmm. I've heard him. Well, sorry, ex-husband.
Greg, and then...
I believe that was two husbands ago.
That was prior to the shark.
But, yeah.
I don't know how you feel about this. If we're talking about tennis commentators, we can't do it without talking about John McEnroe. He probably has the highest profile of all of them.
Definitely.
And I've come to learn that he's one of the most hated tennis commentators out there. And there's probably a good reason for it. And the common complaint is that he makes no effort to know things. Stated plainly.
That's you know? Such a succinct way of saying it. I really enjoy that. John Wertheim actually... He didn't call out McEnroe by name, but he said, you know, it's just not a good look when you're saying things like, I have no idea who this player is. It just makes you look bad.
It does.
You know, it's not.
He says it like it's no big deal.
Right. And so it's obvious that he's not really paying attention to tennis aside from the majors that he's working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he brings a lot to tennis commentary.
Yeah, because I'm not one of
strictly
those.
Strictly of who he is, you know.
But I'm also not one of those who thinks that he's totally useless. You know, I do think that his vast knowledge of the sport from when he played, that brings something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's able to analyze situations inside the match pretty well. But when it comes to like the in-depth knowing of people and like pretending like, excuse my language, but that you give a shit, you know, he falls so short.
Right. Yeah. One thing I'll say in his favor is that he is pretty good humored about himself and his strained relationships. you know, he'll give props to Bjorn Borg and even Jimmy Connors, and we know how they feel about each mm-hmm. other to this day. You know, of course, there's a lot of playing up to his brand. You know, his brand is you cannot be serious, the brash brat.
Bad boy.
Yeah. And so he obviously is really proud of that part mm-hmm. of him, which I find so tiresome.
Yes. So before we get into the part that I'm really excited for, I can't believe I've been sitting here being able to get through this last half hour in anticipation of it. What can we recap as far as if we were to send a memo to ESPN and say, hey guys, you know, this is what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
What would those things be?
So our pointers?
Yes. Shut up.
Or more diplomatically, talk less.
Know your shit.
Yeah, be experts. I'll be translating.
Okay. Don't fuck up.
Are we allowed to say that?
Well, you said it on the last episode.
I did?
Well, you said F.
Okay, welcome to kindergarten. Yeah, don't make silly mistakes that yeah. any idiot with an iPhone can figure
right.
out.
This is 2015, people. Like, look it up. Google's yeah. there for a reason.
Like, our grandparents know how to yeah. use Google, okay?
There are so many resources that you can find on air. Like, I'm on my phone looking at stuff right now.
Yeah, we're totally uninterested in this. We're actually just texting right now. keep it light, keep it fun, and...
Don't take yourself too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the thing that that's probably why I like Cahill so much. He's so unassuming, mm-hmm. and it's so endearing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there's a shine that the likes of Everett and Shriver and the McEnroes feel like they need to maintain on right. their brand and their image that detracts from the tennis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Darren doesn't have that, nor does he want to have that. You know, and that's mm-hmm. what makes him the best.
And one thing I didn't mention: give us some juicy stories. I realize you have to keep access to players mm-hmm. and you don't want to indulge in rumors and stuff, but I don't know, give us some drama from back in your day in the 1976 French Open, you know?
Well, John McEnroe does do a little bit of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is probably the thing he does mm-hmm. best. One of like three things.
That's true. Reminiscing. And
I mean, if he's not going to take the time to keep up on what's going on, now that's all he can draw on, you know?
Right. And when things are going on court, like a streaker, you gotta tell us what's going on. I know it's like the network's policy not to show us that stuff, but we need to know.
So, back in 2008, Justin Gimelstob gave a radio interview. As far as sexism and misogyny in sport goes, this was an all-timer. And... you know, I wish the Body Serve were around back in 2008, then we could have done this back then. In truth, it's something that I only became aware of in totality, like last year. And it's just been stewing with me since then. Like, I've been waiting for this moment, you know? The first time I read the transcript of that interview, my mouth was agape. Like, I just could not. I don't think I've ever read something as ghastly in sport for somebody in his position. I just couldn't. I still can't.
Well, let's get into it.
Okay. So his main target was Anna Kournikova.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after giving this interview, he was to play in World Team Tennis, and he's going to be playing against Kournikova. And I guess this is one of those, those sport talk radio shows where they're all, you know, bro-y and... Mm. talking a lot of smack, you know? So this wasn't an academic setting, to give you that kind of context.
Mm.
But he said things like he called her a bitch.
Yeah.
He called her a douche. He wouldn't date her because she's a douche. Whatever that means.
Uh-huh.
When asked as to whether he would date her, he said he wouldn't, but he wouldn't mind having his younger brother, who's kind of a stud, nail her and then reap the benefits of that.
I don't know what that means, really.
Like, I'm still picking my jaw off the ground.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't understand this. And this is somebody who, shortly before, was elected to the ATP board as the player representative. He was then a Tennis Channel commentator. He had at the time, a long-standing column on Sports Illustrated, where he had a long history of giving his sexist ideas in print. And he was met with so little pushback.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was outrage from some of the people who follow tennis on the internet. I've since gone back and done a lot of research with the stuff that was written about it back then. And a lot of people on the internet were upset, but the ATP did nothing. He got no sanctions from the ATP. He's still in that position as ATP rep. He's still on Tennis Channel.
Yeah, he was suspended from Tennis Channel, but he's back.
He's been suspended many times from Tennis Channel, it seems. He was suspended. The one that really surprised me is that World Team Tennis suspended him for one game. One match. Like, no disrespect. Like, World Team Tennis is not the Davis Cup. It's not Fed Cup, even.
Mm-hmm.
And we know their stature in the tennis world. This is an organization that's influenced and run by people like Billie Jean King, who have a long history of struggle for equality in sport.
Mm-hmm.
And what would it have done them to really make a strong statement against Kimmel Stemmanis?
It's not like he is Roger Federer.
You know,
it's not like they're going to lose a lot of revenue with him not playing. He's someone who reached number 63 in the ranking. That was his highest rank, right? I think I read that today. And the World Team Tennis thing just smacked of a PR move, mm-hmm. just so he wouldn't be playing against Kornikova in that match.
But it seems to me that he's somebody that's so well connected within tennis circles. And it speaks to our previous conversations of the conflicts of interest. Like, this is why he's been allowed to metastasize over these years. Because he seems to be well-liked and he knows people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when you have a sporting culture and a professional tennis culture that's so close-knit and interconnected, you're able to perpetrate all these cover-ups so seamlessly.
There are so many people willing to make excuses for you,
mm-hmm.
when you're a member of a privileged class. And I don't think we need to explain what that means.
No.
But after this whole thing happened, he apologized and... I mean, okay, so you apologized. The things you said were heinous and horrible, but there's so many people willing to go to bat for him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many people willing to say, you know, he works so hard.
Tennis.com 2 years ago, Tennis Magazine did this piece. I mean, I could barely get through it tonight.
Oh my God, stop.
And talking about Gimelstab, that's his last name. I've made so many play on words with his last name that I... talking about the Gimelstab empire. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Like, come on. And like, nowhere in that write-up is any trace of problematizing all the heinous things he's said over the years, you know? That's the thing that people don't... A lot of people understand, but those who want to defend Gimelstab won't acknowledge is that this is not a one or two time free pass.
Mm-hmm.
This is a multitude of quote unquote faux pas over the years.
Yeah.
You know?
To say it's a gaffe really discounts how mean-spirited and just gross it was.
And violent. One of the things that I found really disgusting about it is how sexually violent his words were. I'm sorry, but that was rapey. Saying that you're going to have your brother nail her just so that fun of it. It's frat boy rapey.
The word for that is hate fucking.
Yes.
Which is disgusting.
It's disgusting.
Which is a euphemism in itself.
And in that role, he's playing the pimp.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, which gives him entitlement and ownership of Kornikova's body.
Mm-hmm. And so... You know, for someone in a privileged position, in a public position, to denigrate a female athlete like this, it's not acceptable. And the ATP standing by and doing nothing is so embarrassing.
I'll tell you their exact statement. They said the ATP cannot condone any form of intolerance, and Justin Gimelstab's comments last week were unacceptable. However, Justin has done the right thing in taking full responsibility for his comments, by apologizing publicly to Anna for what he has rightly described as his disappointing and disrespectful comments. And that was that.
That's it.
Disappointing and disrespectful.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think this really... it speaks to the lack of leadership in tennis as a whole.
Especially on the ATP.
Yes. I'm talking about organizationally, mm-hmm. too. You know, there's no commissioner of tennis. You have the WTA, the ATP, and the tournaments. And so the ATP and WTA are supposed to represent both the players' interests and the tournament directors' interests, which is insane. Because there's no players' union, first of all. Mm-hmm. There's no players' association.
You talk about this all the time, yes, not having a union.
It's because all of the major sports do.
Yeah.
You know, the NFL has a players' association, NHL. The players in tennis have no collective rights. And now, what I mean by this power vacuum at the top is that there's no leadership in what do we do, how do we deal with a situation like this. I will say the WTA under Stacey Alistair has shown just nearly a masterful public relations stroke with the comments by Tarpashev,
mm-hmm.
on Russian TV talking about, the Williams brothers, as he said, talking about their bodies, making really gross gender comments. Yeah. Stacey Alistair banned him. She's like, fine,
I will say that this was 7 years ago. Set aside the fact that he's still on air and he's still in his various jobs, working on his empire. If he were to have done that today, I think the response would have been much different. I'm not going to say it would have been different from the ATP, mm-hmm. because they've been poor on so many levels, even in the last couple of years.
Yes.
So I would expect the same from them.
Mm-hmm. Stacey Alistair would not have been quiet about it.
No.
You know.
And I don't think the players themselves, all those players who came to defend him, would have been as quick to do so. Because tennis Twitter and social media has given people so much more access to tennis in the last few years that I don't think he would have been able to survive it.
Mm.
So maybe the timing was different, and I'm not going to give him the benefit of the doubt in terms of, you know, people changing and learning from their mistakes, because I don't think that that's what this is, you know?
And there are enough people doing that.
There is.
You know, there are enough, yes, people giving him leeway, so...
But I do want to acknowledge that this is not us talking about it when it did happen. Like, significant time has passed, you know, so...
We're reading it from a 2015 perspective, right?
Yes.
Okay, fair enough.
That being said, back to the violently sexually aggressive nature of his comments.
Mm-hmm.
He also said, speaking of Kournikova in that upcoming WTT match, she's going to be serving 40 miles an hour and I'm going to be just plugging it down her throat.
I don't think that needs any unpacking.
Can you see my, you see my face right now.
We're laughing because we're trying not to vomit.
Like, I'm so filled with rage. Like, I go back to this periodically from time to time, and I've meant to write something about it, but it's just been so upsetting for so long. And I think of during the Australian Open, I saw a segment where Tennis Channel was in studio and Gimelstab was there with Martina Navratilova. And the thing that came to my mind was, how is it that she is able to sit there beside this dude, knowing everything that he's done over the years, given her politics? And I immediately realized that that was a bit unfair to project all of that onto her.
Mm-hmm.
And I did find that she called his comments moronic when it happened, which you can so hear Martina saying that, those words, you know. But she's she can leave the job whenever she wants, but like, she's being contractually forced to sit beside somebody who potentially she views as a massive bigot, you know?
And who knows, maybe she likes him.
Maybe.
You know, a lot.
That's the thing.
We develop relationships with people whose views we find repugnant on certain things. It happens. So, I don't know. It's just, it's interesting, a thought experiment to think about those two sitting alone together. What do they talk about?
It's just something that came to my mind when I saw them, you know? just wondering if I could be a fly on the wall. And I will backtrack. You know, I'm not trying to like open myself up to any kind of lawsuit. I retract the bigot comment. I take that back. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep talking about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fact that he's been able to keep his job and people not talk about it doesn't mean that we should forget.
Right.
You know?
And so there was another comment. He was quoted in an Out.com article about a gay tennis player. The potential of a major tennis player coming out. He's also he's really like a go-to guy for quotes, you know, because he's seen as a straight shooter.
Which is what's given as the excuse for when he misses the mark, right?
Yeah, because straight shooter a lot of times is just code for dick.
Yes.
You know?
You say whatever you want without any thought or consideration for anybody else.
Yeah. So the article quoted John Wertheim and Jim Courier as saying they think the tour would be pretty open and that this player might even become a celebrity, you know, because of the huge gay fan base. And even Ivan Ljubicic said, you know what, it's not going to be a big deal when it happens. But Justin Gimelstad,
he said, I think there's a 100% chance that a player who comes out would be an outcast and wouldn't be signing a deal for Viagra or Trojans, because that's number one on the priority list.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
Which tennis players are sponsored by Viagra and Trojan? I can't think of any.
Like, maybe Federer, if he's, like, still playing in 10 years? Like, I don't know.
Oh, my God. Cialis commercials. Can you imagine?
Let's not miss what's being quoted there, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he's then calling into question the sexual, quote-unquote, normality of gays.
Right.
Right? And he goes on to say that. Not in as many words.
Yeah, this is good too.
Yeah. When he's saying that the locker room is a homophobic place, but we're not gay bashing. There's just a lot of positive, normal, hetero talk about pretty girls and working out and drinking beer. That's why people want to be pro athletes. I mean, this is like, my brain cannot process such basic ideas. You know, like, this is like,
yeah,
this is crazy to me.
Because he's laying out like the normative experiences for straight men.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty girls, working out, and drinking beer. So, I mean, gay men,
they can do all those things.
Working out and drinking beer.
And talk about pretty girls.
I like drinking beer.
Yeah.
Not working out.
If you have a gay friend and you're a straight man, you will talk about pretty girls.
Right.
But and also,
but it also sells men short.
It does.
Because it makes them mm-hmm. sound like Neanderthals.
Buffoons.
Yeah. And maybe his friends are, but...
And people talk about how he went to Stanford, he had this 4.0 GPA, and how he's smart and whatnot, but he's really doing himself a serious injustice by these series of comments.
Right.
No, these are not the comments of an intellectual person.
And let me lay something down right here.
Mm-hmm.
When you're the one who says, oh, I think there would be a problem among other people on the tour.
You're talking about people. Yourself.
It's you.
It's you.
It's almost always mm-hmm. you. You know? When
Preach.
You say, it's not me. Like, I don't have a problem. I'm not homophobic, but the locker room is very homophobic. Listen, you're part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You may be the problem.
And when he says there's just a lot of positive, normal, hetero talk, those three words together, positive, normal, hetero, decoded, means negative, not normal, homosexual. It's plain as day. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no mistaking what he's trying to say.
That gays are not normal.
Yes. I mean, we sound so ridiculous speaking about those terms, but these are the words that he's given us to use and decode, you know?
Now, he's recently joined John Isner's team as his coach, which, let me tell you, if there could ever be a more perfect partnership in tennis, I'm not holding back here. You know, there seems to be this American right-wing tennis cabal, and Lindsay Davenport is the president. And, you know, there you have John Isner, Justin Gimelstab. It's like this arch-conservative country club within American tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just going through John Isner's Twitter page today, actually. And I'm actually just clearing the vomit out of my throat.
Did it read like the tennis version of The Onion?
No, it was like Atlas Shrugged for Dummies. No, but it's just, you know, you're free to have whatever political affiliation you want. And I'm free to criticize it whenever I want. But it's just so weird. He's got a lot of posts about George W. Bush, who at this point, his own party despises him. Mm-hmm. So who are you? Are you part of like the 15% of Republicans who want to celebrate him? You know, pictures of him throwing out the first pitch at some baseball game. And it's part of this project to make George W. seem like a lovable buffoon again and not a horrible war criminal.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, stupid shit like that. And Lindsay Davenport and Justin Gimel Staub are supposedly tight.
They're so they're a lot good of friends.
I'm sure her influence helps. You know, but Lindsay was, they were tight with Tiger Woods and his family. She's a Bush supporter. Yeah, there's just sort of this upper crust country club feeling around these
three.
Yeah.
I'm depressed.
About?
After having talked about all this stuff, you know? You know, well, at the very least, their partnership has been a colossal failure thus far. So there's that.
In Jamaica, where Jonathan comes from, that's called bad mind.
I urge you to look that up on Urban Dictionary. Definitions are readily available on the internet. It's something that will, if you're able to use that turn of phrase correctly in your life, it will add so much quality to it and enjoyment. So learn that. Bad mind.
So to kind of recap our takedown of Justin Gimel Staub, I think to me why this is important and why I wanted to talk about it is it shows the responsibility that commentators have. And Jonathan and I come from a place where we think that language is productive.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is that the words that we put out there into the public,
they matter.
Have material effects. Mm-hmm. You know, they have real consequences.
And they contribute to creating a positive narrative, especially in sport, where women are marginalized, gays are marginalized, where, as in regular society, white straight men have all the privilege. You know, people like Justin Gimel Staub, who come from this privileged class, their words matter. Like, when you dismiss him as just being, you know, somebody who's a straight talker, who missed the mark, who is, you know, he's just caught up in the locker room atmosphere. You know, he's a product of his being an athlete. You know, that doesn't help us move forward.
And I think it's important to note that only certain types of speech are allowed to be considered straight talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it depends who's saying it, first of all.
We've talked about this many times. Things that, so you could put the exact same words in Serena Williams' mouth, mm-hmm. and put them in Justin Gimel Staub's mouth, and they'd have totally right. different effects.
And, you know, you may think this is tired, but women straight talkers are too often called bitches,
mm-hmm.
nags.
The same bitches that Justin Gimel Staub is calling Kournikova.
Right. So I urge everyone, when they think about what candor and what straight talk means, think about who you're giving that privilege to.
And if that privilege you're giving to, if the person you're giving that privilege to is a white straight man, think twice about it. And think twice about the many other times they've been given that free pass.
And honestly, I'm a white gay man. I'm given a pass on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So do it to me too.
Yeah.
You know, I know that I have a privilege in our culture that a lot of people don't. So, you know, that's why we want to hear from you.
We just should expect more from people. There's nothing wrong with expecting more from people, especially people who should know better, who are in position to know better and do better. Enough with the preaching, right? I feel like...
Yeah. I feel like a lot of you may be on the same page, just maybe not to the degree.
Yeah. This is our most, probably our most political preachy episode that we've done.
Mm.
But no, we want you to know that this is something that we feel strongly about. And hopefully it gives you some insight into what we bring to this podcast that might be different from other tennis podcasts that you listen to. And we'd love to hear your feedback. Let us know on Twitter at the Body Serve. You can find us there. Write us a review on iTunes. We'd love for this to be a more interactive experience. We know it's new, and so, you know, it's taking a while to catch on. But we look forward to having more interaction with you guys.
Mm-hmm. And thank you to everyone who has interacted with us so far. It's honestly, it's exceeded my expectations right off the bat. So I'm so appreciative.
There are quite a few people who we can actually call regular listeners now. And your feedback every time we post an episode, it's almost too much. But let's keep some more coming. It's never enough. Luther Vandross comes to mind. Never too much, never too much, or whatever. Thanks for listening. We'll probably get back to you sometime between Indian Wells and Miami, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
And we also look forward to experiencing Rafa's climb to number 10 at some point this spring.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant ranking. I was like, how dare you? He means French Open, just so you know.
10th French Open. Okay. All right. Till next time.